You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, December 12, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, 12, 12, 12. Enjoy it, folks. Can't happen again. In all of our lives, unless, of course, they add a 13th month, which it doesn't seem to be in the works. On the program today, Becky Bond, Vice President of Credo Mobile, Political Director of Credo Action, to talk to us about what Credo does in addition to sponsoring the Majority Report for this month and offering Majority Report listeners an amazing deal. As of December 31st, 40% off your monthly voice fee for 1 year. Contract buyout credit up to $350. Unlimited data. And an opportunity to put your money where your mouth is. Put your mouth where your money is. Where your dollars goes towards the political values you have. We'll be talking to Becky Bond about that. Then we'll be talking to filmmaker Ken Burns on his latest film, which he co-directed with his daughter, and about the Central Park Five, an amazing documentary, devastating. Just... really an amazing snapshot at a period of time, really lasting over almost 20 years over the course of in New York City. We will get to both of those just shortly. Also on the program today, we'll get to that story about Texas dealing with the implications of cutting family planning funds. And in Scalia, such a charming fellow, could only come up with one metaphor for having a problem with homosexuality, and that, of course, is murder. Of course. Michelle Bachmann, still crazy after all these weeks. And more on the fiscal cliff, the implications of cutting Medicare. We're going to take a quick break in just a moment and speak to Becky Bond. But I want to – this is obviously a big sponsor for the Majority Report. I spoke about this on Monday. We've been looking for a sponsor where they are not only entrepreneurial and not only something that's not offensive to us, but something that actually expands the reach of this program and simultaneously – edifies what we're doing and allows you to support the program while also simultaneously support the political views that you have and get a great deal from a great company. So this is very exciting for us. And again, they have this special deal that's lasting now for, I guess, another 2.5 weeks. So you can visit majority.fm. We've got a link in today's blog post. We got a link at the on the front page if you scroll down. So check it out. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk to Becky Bond about what Credo is doing that you can get involved with now, in addition to, obviously, the way they fund it through selling mobile phones. Hope you liked that interview with Becky Bond from Credo Mobile. You just heard her talk about Credo. And majority reporters know that we try and put our money where our mouth is when it comes to our sponsors. I can't say enough about Credo Mobile. They're our newest sponsor. Frankly, they're the only sponsor I would want. And they're the only progressive cell phone company that exists anywhere. This is really the best of both worlds for me. We get to support an organization that fights Republican Tea Party extremists, holds Democrats accountable, funds the progressive movement, and then helps keep this show on air. It's really easy to sign up now. Go to credomobile.com/majority. You get 40% off your monthly voice fee for 1 year. You get total true unlimited data. And they'll even give you a buyout credit of $350 to get out of your contract from one of those big corporate phone cell service providers. So check it out today. CredoMobile.com/majority. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Becky Bond. She is the VP of Credo Mobile and the political director of Credo Action. Did I get that right, Becky?
Yeah, that's right. I'm the political director at Credo. I'm also a vice president. I'm also president of Credo Super PAC, which is my newest and most favorite title.
All right. Well, great. I mean, that's a great place to start because one of the things that I know that that Credo, the PAC, was involved in was targeting specific House races, Tea Party races. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a funny thing, Sam. You know, at Credo, we believe, like you and your listeners believe, that there should be no corporate money in politics. But when we saw what happened in 2010 with all the money from the Koch brothers and money raised by Karl Rove sweeping in the most radical extremist Republicans that we've seen in my lifetime in the House, we knew that we had to do something. So Credo Action, we have 3 million members, and we asked them, should Credo form a super PAC to defeat some of the most extreme Republicans in the House, the guys that were trying to take away birth control and redefine rape, the guys that denied the science behind climate change, and they overwhelmingly said, yes, let's form a super PAC and let's defeat some of these guys. So we targeted 10 of the most vulnerable and extreme Tea Party Republicans in the House, incumbents, and we set up an amazing grassroots volunteer field operation, storefront offices in every district. We hired organizers, we recruited volunteers, and we helped defeat 5 of our 10 incumbents in an amazing race. If I had told you a year ago that with a few $100,000, Credo would set up an operation in Allen West District, and despite his raising spending $13 million to defend his seat, that we could make the difference in that race and turn him into former Congressman Allen West, you would think I was crazy, but that's exactly what we did.
And you some of the other highlights, Dan Lundgren, which is a big one in California, Joe Walsh in Illinois. I have mixed feelings just because we used to have so much tape from that guy. I could build any daily show off of some of the ridiculous things that he was espousing. But nice to see at least those three go. And it was the other one was Kravac in Minnesota and.
And Frank Ginta in New Hampshire. Right. And Frank Ginta, he was a Tea Party freshman who actually came from his local Tea Party organization and was elected in 2010 as a freshman and was the most anti-woman member of Congress. And we ran a really effective operation up there. He is now going to be former Congressman Frank Ginta, and we reelected one of the most anti-war members of Congress from the former Congress, Carol Shea Porter. So we're really proud of that work. Credo members had a big hand in that race, and we're really excited about seeing that guy out the door.
Now, I guess I should have said up front that, I mean, I did before we brought you on, but obviously Credo is sponsoring this program. And it is, from my perspective, I mean, I've told my audience this multiple times now, but yours is an organization that I have always had great admiration from. And of all of the groups, the organizations out there that are mobilizing, one of the things that I think is most impressive about Credo is how independent and you guys are. So, I mean, it's not just a question of you're targeting with the PAC Tea Partiers, but you guys fight for, I mean, I don't, obviously I'm blowing a little smoke here, but not really. I mean, you guys fight for real progressive values. You manage to do it in a way that is, I think, distinct from other groups. And part of that has to do with the way that you guys are funded. Will you just tell us, you know, the evolution of Credo from working assets to Credo, how you guys fund what you do, and what are the actions that you take outside of the PAC as well?
Sure. That's a great question. Much like you, Sam, when you're outside of the mainstream media, you can actually really speak truth to power, and it's the same thing with Credo and how we fund our activism. We're really a social change organization that instead of going to big donors and asking for money, we run a phone company. And the proceeds and the revenue from that phone company funds our activism. So we only have to answer to our conscience when we go out there and run campaigns. We don't have any donors saying, oh, don't talk about that right now, or we can't hold the president accountable because we need to reelect him. We get to go out there and we get to fight for choice. We get to fight to stop the wars. We get to fight to hold Wall Street accountable no matter what anyone says. And the more that we work to be successful and say what we believe and hold people in power accountable no matter what party they're in, that's the more people want to participate in our activism and become customers of Credo Mobile. We started about 25 years ago, and we were started by a group of progressive economists who just didn't want to raise money, but they wanted to make sure that great progressive groups, not just do-gooder groups, but progressive groups that were fighting for choice, fighting for justice in Central America, could have funding, a revenue stream that would be independent of all these corporations were funding bad things, but there were no corporations funding good things. So they founded a really good company called Working Assets. And for a long time, Working Assets was a long-distance company, and many of you may know it as that. And one of the great things about Working Assets was that just every month when you paid your bill, a portion of the money that you gave to the company went to great groups. And over the years, we're the largest corporate contributor to Planned Parenthood. We've given over $1 million to the Rainforest Action Network. We fund lots of great groups through their phone service. Now, as long distance goes away, we decided that what we needed to really do is be a mobile phone company because fewer people had long distance, but everybody was getting mobile phones. And so when we changed, moved into the mobile business, we changed our name to Credo Mobile, and we started doing the fierce kind of activism and getting our customers to switch their long distance to Credo Mobile, and that's where we are today.
And so let's talk about some of, how does it break down with Credo Mobile spends part of its profits in supporting these different groups, and you can people can check it out by heading to credomobile.com/majority, and there you can see all the different actions that are taking place. what Credo has supported through the years, very transparent in that respect. What are the
It's really an interesting model because and it's not even just the profits. What we do is we give a portion of our revenue. So literally every time, you know, you pay your phone bill, if you're a Credo Mobile customer, part of that money goes to the progressive nonprofits that we're supporting, whether it's Planned Parenthood or whether it's Doctors Without Borders or whether it's Democracy Now. The money goes, no matter whether we're making a profit or not, a portion of your phone bill goes directly to those groups. We also run, you know, where other companies are running marketing campaigns, you know, we just have as part of Credo, we have a big team that works to organize our customers and our Credo Action members to do progressive activism. And so where some companies have marketing expenses that would be ads, what we do is we plow the money from those phone bills back into one of the best online to offline progressive organizing teams in the country. And that's what made Credo Super PAC possible. That's what makes our campaign to stop the Keystone XL pipeline run. It's the money that comes in from the phone bills that pay for that. So not only can we run these amazing activism campaigns, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have been a part of, but we also have given over $70 million to great progressive nonprofits. And again, like I said, you know, we are the number one corporate contributor to Planned Parenthood, and that's something that we're really proud of, and that's something that the customers make possible.
You know, on Monday, I was interviewing Digby from the blog Hullabaloo, and we were talking about how this is a fairly unique time for people of our ilk, those who have been working on the outside, trying to agitate and put and gain some leverage. With House members in the Democratic caucus, with the president. And now that the president has been reelected, this is really a key time and one, I think, where outside groups are empowered. She mentioned Credo, among other progressive organizations that are really trying to leverage people power to force and stiffen the spines of particularly the Democratic caucus in the House as we enter into this fiscal cliff, however you want to brand it, fiscal austerity bomb, this potential grand bargain, the debt ceiling fight. What are you guys doing right now in terms of, because I know that back in even as early as March, you guys were pressuring Steny Hoyer and exposing his position where he's putting things like Medicare and Social Security on the table in negotiations with the Republicans.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Like you and like Digby, we believe in an outside model of power. We think change comes from the outside. We don't think that if we walk into the office of Steny Hoyer on Capitol Hill, you know, that we'll be able to make an inside deal and he'll fight for everything that we believe in, like no cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits. We believe that the politicians in Washington, D.C., whether Republicans or Democrats, they only do the things, most of them, that we make them do because they're under enormous pressure from the right. And so when you look at a phone company like AT&T, they're one of the biggest campaign contributors to Congress, and they're certainly the biggest contributor to the members of the Tea Party caucus. What we do instead of giving money to right-wing politicians is we organize millions of people to speak out at moments like this where we're facing this fiscal bluff. And, you know, with Steny Hoyer and also with Chris Van Hollen, you know, when these guys make comments in the news, they'll say things like, you know, I think we should consider raising the Social Security retirement age. Or Chris Van Hollen recently, who's the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, he recently said, yeah, I think, it, you know, I personally am not necessarily for cutting benefits, but I think that benefits for Medicare and Medicaid, they ought to be on the table. And when these guys say things like this, we immediately shoot out an email to our Credo Action members in their district, and we say, we want you to give Steny Hoyer a phone call like we did in March. And we say, give him a phone call and tell him that you are absolutely opposed to this being on the table at all. We generated about 5,000 calls, not just from Hoyer's district, but because he's part of the leadership, from across the country to him saying, just you cannot talk about putting this stuff on the table. Recently, Chris Van Hollen, just a couple of weeks ago, said something about this all ought to be on the table in an interview with the Wall Street Journal. And we had a bunch of people from his district call in. And let me just tell you the angry call we got at Credo HQ from his chief of staff, saying that we mischaracterized it, and we read back the quote. Did he say this? And he's like, that's not what he meant. And we said, you know, and they said, stop misinforming your people. And we said, you know what? We think that Chris Van Hollen should make a public statement saying that he would absolutely not vote for any bill that would contain cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits. And they said, well, we're not going to make that statement. And then we said, well, we're going to keep those phone calls coming. So it's our job to make people in power uncomfortable, and the elites in Washington, D.C., on both sides are just way too apt to give away things that people in their district hold dear, like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits. So we're with our people, and we're going to fight to the end on this. And, you know, we don't believe in compromise as a place where you start in these arguments. We believe that you say what you want to win, and then you fight for it, and then you see where you are at the end. You don't compromise at the beginning. And that's what we do as a company, and that's what our members want to do. And it's our job to help fight for the progressive values, not get in the back room and make a terrible compromise where the people that voted into office have no power at all.
I got to say that not only do I love that your credo of folks were able to force Van Hollen's office to call you, but I love the fact that you can talk about it. Because so often, I mean, this is sort of the thing that I've been trying to communicate to people, is that so often with these groups, they'll do an action like this, they will get that call, and they can't talk about the fact that they get that call, because somehow it's that relationship is where the leverage is. But here it is literally, you're putting their feet under the fire, and it doesn't make a difference if they know that you're talking about it, because it continues to compounds that pressure. And that's one of the things I really appreciate. Now, we just got a couple minutes here, so I got a couple questions in terms of the phone service, but also we've had great, great response from our listeners already, and ranging from, Sam, you're a bad marketer because you didn't tell us that the Majority Report promo, people get a $350 credit to buy out our existing contract. I'm going to do a better job with that. One of the things that people wanted to ask me about was, one, are you guys going to get the iPhone? Right now, you're talking to me on a Samsung Galaxy. Sounds great. Some people wanted to know about the iPhone. What's a chance?
Well, so right now we don't have the iPhone. I do not know what the future holds. You know, right now I'm talking to you on the Galaxy S3, which is an awesome phone. You know, you probably know as much as I do if you read in the newspaper about what's going on with Apple and supply chain and all that right. Kind of stuff. Personally, if we get the iPhone, I'm going to stick with my Android Galaxy S3. In part because, first of all, it's a faster phone, and I think it's a better phone, but also because I've become addicted to swipe. Now, I don't know if you're using
people
this,
have told me that, yes.
So this is something the iPhone doesn't have, and someone in D.C. who's an activist challenged me. He said that he can write emails faster with one hand and swipe, or as fast with one hand on swipe on public transit than he can at his keyboard of his MacBook. And wow. So I've taken up this challenge myself, and I think that the Galaxy S3 is an awesome phone, and also Android as an open source platform is one where there's actually more innovation going into it. So we're right now we don't have the iPhone. I don't know what the future holds, but I know that I'm sticking with my Galaxy.
All right, now I got to ask you one other question that was brought up, and I ask this with the understanding that, you know, look, there's no perfect solution when you're talking about commerce in some way to avoid, to get into a situation where everything is sort of perfectly aligned with your values. But one of the things that people asked about, now granted, AT&T is given nearly $1 million to Tea Party candidates, which is just sort of shocking in a way. One of the things that people have brought up is that the relationship with Sprint, which is the network where Credo works on, is not unionized. Is that the case? What's the story with Credo and unions?
So the only carrier that has some unionized workforce for mobile is AT&T. And you know it's a really complex thing. First of all, we really encourage people to consider their values and the things that are most important to them when they spend any of their money, whether it's on their phone service or the food they eat, you know, for any of those things. So we really applaud your listeners for interrogating, you know, this mm-hmm. decision. It's really complicated. It's really complicated when you look at the record on if you care about labor issues. Credo supports the Employee Free Choice Act. Credo has been organizing our members in Indiana to fight the right wing, right to work power grab. We've sent out every email that's been asked of us by the AFL-CIO on this terrible Michigan power grab. AT&T was one of the top 10 contributors to Scott Walker when he ran for governor in Wisconsin. And AT&T is a top contributor to the Republican Governors Association, and AT&T obviously is the biggest giver to the Tea Party caucus. Credo, again, we support workers' rights. We fund groups like Jobs with Justice, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. We've worked with Unite Here and SEIU and AFL-CIO. When there is a labor fight, we want to be there. We want to get our members engaged. But it's true that Sprint is the vendor that we use for our network, and Sprint doesn't have a unionized workforce. And we support trade unionization. We support labor rights, but that is a difference. With AT&T, we think that the money that AT&T pours into the right wing, that the fact that AT&T is a top supporter and helped get elected, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, we think these things outweigh the fact that some of their labor force is unionized, and we believe that we have a very strong commitment to labor rights. And anyone in a labor organization that's actually worked with us on one of these issues, I think would tell you that Credo is a strong supporter of labor rights.
Well, I appreciate that, and it is a complicated thing. You're weighing different things, and the work that you guys are doing, I think, is really in many respects unparalleled in terms of bringing this outside force to bear upon our politicians and holding them accountable. And so, I want to remind people that you can go as a Majority Report listener. You get 40% off your monthly voice fee for the first year. You get a contract buyout credit up to $350, true unlimited data, all sorts of phones, smartphones, stupid phones, I guess. I don't know what you call old school phones. And I feel great about this relationship, Becky, and I really appreciate what Credo sponsoring the program.
Well, we're huge fans of the Majority Report. This is exactly the kind of in-depth information about what's going on in Washington D.C. and the states and the progressive fights that people don't have access to. And if we can help get more listeners for your show and help support your work, it's just a really wonderful marriage of two great progressive forces. So we're really happy to be with you on the Majority Report.
Great, thank you. It's credomobile.com/majority. Check it out, folks. You got to December 31st for this special offer. Becky, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ken Burns. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the director, Ken Burns, co-director, with Sarah Burns and David McMahon of the Central Park Five. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I watched the film last night. It is an incredible documentary. It is in many respects heartbreaking and enraging. It is, of course, the story of five then teenagers who were in many, I don't know how else to put this, they were railroaded and through their coerced confessions were held accountable and imprisoned for years for a horrible assault and rape of a woman in Central Park that took place back in 1989. Tell us how you decided, how you came about making this film, choosing this topic.
Really, the subject was born in my own daughter's sense of outrage and fairness. She had became familiar with this case in 2003 when the five had been recently exonerated. A lot of good it did them because they'd served out their full sentences. And she became passionately interested in trying to tell the story that wasn't told. Those people who will remember, 1989 was a real feeding frenzy, not just mistakes by cops and prosecutors, but clearly mistakes by the media who bought the scenario that the cops and prosecutors promoted hook, line, and sinker without the usual skepticism that journalism sort of requires us to do. And had anyone applied that skepticism, cops, prosecutors, or media, the five would not have been in the position they were, which is serving up to 13 years of a sentence. And she decided to write a book, and her husband, David McMahon, and I had the great privilege of looking over her shoulder as she was beginning to work on that, and looked at each other, all three of us, and said, my goodness, it's a film, too. And so we worked for several years. Her book came out last year in 2011. Her film has just been released theatrically around the country, and it's just an attempt to give voice to the five who were denied a voice at the time. They were turned into pariahs. They were the wolf pack wilding, a bunch of beasts and animals, the language of Jim Crow America at the beginning of the 20th century, not the progressive city that New York is. Supposedly was at the end of the 20th century, and to also ask some tough questions about what actually happened. Why did this miscarriage of justice take place?
You know, there's so many facets about this because the stories of these individual now men it's so painful.
It is. I think that heartbreak is a really good word to use. One is outraged, I think, when one sees the way in which the noose tightened around them without any apparent help. Their attorneys, with the exception of one, were essentially useless. Their community turned against them. In some cases, their own family members turned against them, and they were innocent. They were young kids who'd done pretty well, lower middle class in school. They hadn't done anything wrong. And they didn't know about lawyering up, but there were a lot of kids in the park that night making mischief. There was one other felony committed that they may or may not have witnessed. But what we know for sure happened that night is they weren't involved with the infamous Central Park jogger rape. Someone else did it. And the cops blew it. They had his name 2 days before on another assault and didn't follow through. And then this guy went on, because they became so focused on the five, this guy went on to rape and maim and even kill a pregnant woman before he was not caught by the police but by people in the community. And no one in that same summer of 89 thought, well, geez, these kids don't know anything about this crime. Maybe this unknown semen sample that we have matches. And they didn't walk it from one case to another. There were detectives working both cases. And so what happens is that this becomes tragedy compounded. It becomes tragedy, obviously, for the five, obviously for the original victim of the rape, but it's also their family, and each one of the five has a special hell that they have to live through with their own families that challenges them to the very core of their being. And, you know, our film was just an attempt to say, who are you and what actually happened that night?
I think it also, I mean, it certainly, you know, in some ways, I mean, that is the focus of the film. But what happens or happened for me is when you see this sort of this mirror come up. Now, I didn't live in New York City at the time in 1989. I did live in New York City in 2002. I, as someone who was living in Massachusetts at the time in 1989, I knew more about the attack than I never knew about the exoneration. And it struck me, I mean, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you, just for, I guess, sort of from a filmmaking standpoint, but I wanted to bring into the sort of this dynamic is early on, I mean, at the opening of the film, you play the confession from the actual rapist who has also had, like you say, had gone on to kill other people. What was from a filmmaking standpoint, was that to bring out sort of the tragedy from the beginning? Because I didn't even realize that these people had been exonerated, and which was that much more sort of it was that much more painful and
yes.
made me feel
well,
sick.
This is part of our complicity, and I really mean our complicity, because I lived in New Hampshire at the time. I spent some time in New York. I was aware of what was going on. It was the crime of the century, Ed Koch yeah. said. The coverage was not just, you know, saturation coverage in New York City, but around the country and indeed the world picked up on this as a symbol of the decay of the cities, the lawlessness of the cities, how much we'd lost control of our youth, when in fact the crime was committed by a sociopath, a psychopathic guy. And he, strangely enough, is a guy who comes forward and admits his mistake, something that the city of New York hasn't done, or the cops or the prosecutors haven't done, or even the media for that matter. I was aware, too, of how little coverage happened when they were exonerated. And that enraged me, as it would later enrage Sarah. I think that this is, you know, what we did is we decided to move the confession to the beginning so that no matter what you believe going in, what you knew or didn't know, you knew that there was an alternative narrative that could have been presented at the time, and that you get far enough away from that original confession that maybe you haven't forgotten it, but by the time Mateus Reyes, is the name of the man, shows up again, you're in full outrage, because you realize not only has what happened to the boys been so unfortunate, but that there is somebody who's right before them, that right before their eyes, that they have in jail that summer, that did it, and they can't see more than the blinders of their scenario have put on them, and we felt it was an important device so that when they are exonerated at the end of the film, and you know, it's no news story. It's just that it has more power. This is less a question of whodunit than a question of how could this have possibly happened the way it did. And that's why the film is structured as it is. And people go through many, many stages of anger and outrage, the sense of fairness that struck Sarah so strongly and the rest of us, but also the emotions, the heartbreak that you mentioned. All of those you go through in a way as you begin to realize there, but for the grace of God, go I.
When you speak of our complicity, one thing that also occurred to me during the film, after the film, is a comparison to the there were two films made about the so-called Memphis Three. These were three young white teenagers in Memphis.
The West Memphis Three, and there's actually been four films made about them. And you begin to realize that these failures of justice happen all the time in America. And it's interesting that in that case, and part of the celebrity of that is that they're white kids.
Yes.
The problem is that these are black and Hispanic kids, and for them the anonymity is even more painful. This happens all the time, and we have to figure out as a country whether liberty and justice for all is just the window dressing of our pledge of allegiance, or something that's real that we have to insist on. And I think that that's got to be front and center. There are too many people that have been exonerated by the Innocence Project and by DNA. There are too many people that have confessions coerced, or either make false confessions for a variety of complicated reasons that we might not believe are possible, and certainly don't believe that we'd be possible of it, but you never know what would happen in the stress of interrogations. And remember, these were 14, 15, 16-year-old kids who were in interrogations with the finest that New York had to offer for upwards of 30 hours by themselves, usually without their parents, certainly without a lawyer, and that's terrifying.
And I was also struck by the guilt that I think Santana's father felt just involved. I mean, he clearly You know, he felt guilty just because he had told his kid to go play in the park that night. But also, I mean, I think there was a real sense that the parents, I mean, when you talk about the sort of the inequal justice and the sort of the resources and the facilities that that these kids had at their disposal. They had horrible lawyers, almost short of one. They had parents who didn't necessarily know how to.
Nobody knew how to work in the system, and nobody understood their rights. And each one was, as I said, a separate tragedy of parents hoping to help but ending up being in some ways feeling tremendously guilty because they had engineered or helped to engineer or encouraged the cooperation that would result in these confessions and these videotaped statements at the end of hours and hours of interrogation that would essentially hang these kids, that no matter the fact that there were inconsistencies, no matter that there was this unknown, semen sample, regardless of the fact that there was no DNA match to anything, this is a hugely bloody crime scene, and there was nothing of the crime scene on the boys and nothing of the boys on the crime scene. And so you would think that all of this exculpatory evidence would be just that, that would at least permit somebody, even if they were locked and loaded on these five, to entertain at least professionally. You would think it would be part of your job description to entertain alternative narratives, just like a chess master has to say, well, there's several different ways that I could approach this. And it just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. And that, to me, is the tragedy, and it's compounded by the fact that the parents were all there hoping to do the best, being overwhelmed by the system, having jobs and other, you know, kids that they had to take care of, and being essentially all manipulated by the fact that nobody was there saying, you have rights, you don't have to say anything.
No one from the city, none of the detectives, none of the prosecutors involved in this case would speak to you, and you made that clear up front.
Yeah, we said it, you know, it was very unfortunate. We would have been happy to have all voices in the film, and in fact we do, because we went out of our way archivally to find out what they were saying in news conferences and press releases and trial statements and things like that. And we interviewed lots of other journalists who covered the trial at the time, and so we feel we did them justice. But they said they hid behind the skirts of the civil suit that the five had launched against the city in 2003, nearly a decade ago, which, by the way, has had the worst case of the slows put on it. It's just, you know,
It's still ongoing.
Oh, yeah, they've dumped huge requests on the five that they can't, you know, asking Raymond Santana's father for his entire employment history and his entire medical records, and then they themselves are not forthcoming with just simple notes that detectives are required to take and are required to file, and all of a sudden they can't find them or they're delayed, and judges have gotten exasperated at the slow pace of that. But they were just trapped in this story, and that's the thing that is so frustrating when you look at it. This is a tragedy that did not have to happen.
In the course of your filmmaking and your daughter's research for her book, did you guys ever get the sense or hear through back channels or have off-the-record conversations where any of the people who were involved in sending these five to jail from anywhere from 7 to 12, 15 years, did any of them express any remorse? Did any of them say that we just got caught up in the system? Or was there any indication that, you know, this is just the way that we would do police work at that time?
Let me be very, very careful. The principal detectives and assistant DAs have in no way in their back channel, so to speak, their off-the-record comments in any way indicated any remorse, any sort of sense of regret at what took place. They are continuing to insist that this took place all in good faith. But you can't have a 14-year-old kid, under police interrogation for 14, 15 hours or up to 30 hours, get the wrong confession out, let the real guy go, and call this in good faith. and lie on the stand about it, which they all perjured themselves on the stand by saying that they didn't lead these kids into anything. They just asked them what happened. And if it takes 30 hours to get what happened, you know damn well that that's not the case. There have been others, though, who are constrained and unable to speak, who have spoken off the records and indicate a sense that, you know, that that department has egg on its face, that they made a mistake, that, that you know, this has been a terrible travesty of justice. But I have to sort of be careful because off-the-record comments made to journalists, which we are, have to remain that way.
And in fact, the city is subpoenaing some of your footage, is my understanding. And if you can't speak,
they've subpoenaed all of our outtakes and our notes from this production, which is an incredibly outrageous part for a number of reasons. One, it's an obvious violation of our journalistic privileges. It's a violation of the First Amendment. It's a violation of the New York Journalistic Shield laws. It's a huge fishing expedition intended only to find, you know, inconsistencies between comments that the boys have made, you know, like, listen, Sam, you told me you went into the park at 9:01. You told Burns and McMahon that you went at 9:02. Do you always lie? And it also is yet another cynical gesture that is keeping this tragedy from having a period put at the end of it. You know, just having closure is important not just for the victim, not just for the five and their families, but for the city of New York. Yes. And what this is a failure, as the reporter Jim Dwyer, now of the New York Times, then of Newsday, says. It's just people who got stuck in a mistake, and they're still stuck in the mistake. And he says everybody makes mistakes, and you're sort of measured by whether you can own up to your mistakes. And I think that, that they, the prosecutors in the city and the press, the detectives, all of the folks involved in this kind of lynching, have not owned up to their culpability. And it's not my job to make them own up to it. It's my job to tell a story of what happened. And that's Sarah's job and that David McMahon's job, and that's all we've tried to do.
It does,
as you say, you know, add to your outrage and to your heartbreak.
And you know, one thing about the complicity of the city, and I'm talking about in many respects, the media, because it seems to me that this has still been just widely unreported. And
right.
It's one completely. Thing that when
and,
you can look
what
at
what happened
the...
is because the media was silent at the time of their vacation of their convictions, which happened exactly 12 years ago this month. 10 years ago this month, in 2002, a judge acting on a behest on the part of the district attorney as well as the defense, asking for a vacation of the convictions, considering the new evidence that the actual rapist had stepped forward, that there was so much silence on the part of the media that they permitted the reactionary forces to be the only story out there.
Right.
So all the story has been is that, oh, it just must be they're off on a technicality. Oh, that they really did do it, and somehow they've been really – so nobody has invested themselves, with the exception of a few, in really sort of saying, wait a second, we need to be aware of the kind of mistakes. There was a case that happened in the early 60s, a man named George Whitmore, who recently, ironically, died about 2 or 3 months ago. The New York Times had quite a full obituary on him. He had essentially had a confession coerced and for a series of, you know, crimes that were really terrible. And the media took up the case and sort of tested his alibis and found out they were sound. And it eventually led to his exoneration and release. And that eventually led to Miranda, the rights that we all enjoy. This case, on the other hand, led to the death penalty being reinstituted in New York State because of the outrage was so strong over this crime, the symbolism that it meant, the, you know, the frail white woman versus the black beast. This is the imagery of Jim Crow America. This is the imagery of Birth of a Nation and the imagery of Gone with the Wind. This is an imagery that's still around when you see the way in which race causes Americans to vibrate so horribly, whether it's in our political arena or just in our personal lives. And it's really important to just blow the whistle and say, this is who we are, and hold a mirror up to this circumstance, and we're all to blame. You know, we're all to blame.
The fact that the West Memphis Three could be so celebrated, I wonder if that's not a function of the media concentration in New York, being able to judge what's going on in the South, but unable to come to terms with their massive, massive failure in this case.
Well, I think that that may be the case. I'm considering working on another documentary about the assault that Mateus Reyes committed just 2 days before, on April 17th, 1989, in which a young detective had actually done the due diligence and found the name of Mateus Reyes, and then nobody followed through. Nobody tracked it down. Nobody went, and we could have averted a tragedy. And I think that that's a case that needs to be examined, because in many ways that may lead to why people didn't question other aspects at the time of this crime, and then later when they were exonerated during the reinvestigation. There's a lot of stuff that stinks and it's fishy, and so I want to pursue this. But I do think it has to do with the lack of distance on the part of our media that couldn't believe that this could happen right in our own backyards. But, you know, New Yorkers are debating the stop and frisk laws and its efficacy and many other things that sort of belie what we think of as a liberal progressive city at the beginning of the 21st century, and not some horrible Jim Crow thing in the South.
I know you've got to run. I want to just ask you finally, as you're doing this film, has it changed the way that you perceive? I mean, because in many respects, this is a bit of a departure in some respects, I think, from your other films. I mean, has it changed your perspective on not just on filmmaking, but on why you make films? And
I think it hasn't really. I do understand that this represents, because of the extraordinary contribution of David McMahon, who I've had the great pleasure of collaborating with for 14 years, and the presence of my daughter Sarah, that makes her father very proud. I've enjoyed the sort of new creative stylistic things that are introduced into this film. But indeed, almost all of the films that I've made over the past 35 years have had to do, in one way, shape, or another, in race. That's why the Civil War happened. I felt it was the heart of the story of baseball, with Jackie Robinson's ascension and the Negro Leagues that had been a separate but athletically equal league, but denied a chance to play at the highest levels. It's part of jazz, the only art form that Americans have invented, recognized around the world, that was born in an African-American community. It's part of the story of Thomas Jefferson and Jack Johnson, the first African-American heavyweight. It's the story of Mark Twain. These are all subjects of films I've made. So I think when you scratch the surface of American history, you inevitably, without having to look for it, come up with questions and issues about race. So these are not unfamiliar stories to me, but I do think that their contemporariness is what makes them perhaps more shocking and more visceral for those of us who are struggling to understand the inconsistencies and the tragedies in this case.
Well, it's an incredibly powerful film. I can't recommend that people see it enough, and so I want to congratulate yourself and David and your daughter Sarah. It really is just an amazing film, very, very moving, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for giving me a chance to talk about this film. We're very proud of it.
All right. Thank you very. Thanks again. Ken Burns, ladies and gentlemen. We got to take a break and head into the better half of the program. You can call us at 646-257-3920. We've got our IMs up. You can IM us at Majority FM on your instant messaging, or at majority.fm at jabber.org. Folks, it is, obviously we have this huge opportunity to show Credo that this is a show worth supporting, that our audience is interested in what Credo is doing, both on the political action side, and that it's a product that they're interested in engaging with, that will also, as you make phone calls, you're supporting a lot of great organizations, nonprofits, that Credo supports with the revenue that they get from your calls. So it is credomobile.com/majority. Check it out. The offer that they're offering to our listeners is only good till December 31st. 40% off your monthly voice fee for the first year. A contract buyout credit up to $350. Unlimited data. And, of course, all of the good that your phone bill will actually start doing. So check it out today. Other ways of supporting the show, you can become a member at majority.fm. But check out this Credo stuff today because it's, at the very least, worth your going and crunching the numbers and seeing if you can use your phone to support your political beliefs. All right, we're going to take a break. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.